rarely did I ever receive feedback on the kinds of interrogations I did, like what happened to the men I interrogated, where the information went, what was happening as a result of my interrogations. And then one day, I went to my chief in the interrogation center, and he asked me what I was aiming for in this upcoming interrogation, and I said something about weapons caches and this, that, and the other. And he said, no, where is the bomb dropping? Who is getting arrested? What door is going to be knocked down? And it wasn't long after that that I got the one and only feedback from an interrogation that I ever received when I was in Iraq, and I got what was called a double A grade. The first A for good intelligence, and the second A for it was acted upon. And it was a man that I interrogated who was basically a thug, had found a way of capitalizing on a wartime environment in order to make money, to capitalize off of the instability. And I had been getting the grid coordinate, the grid coordinates of various homes of individuals that we were wanting to access, which means that either the bombs were dropped in the coordinates that I provided, or someone was incarcerated. And that's the hard thing to deal with. I've told the story several times about having pointed an M16 at 3 8-year-old boys who were walking along the side of our convoy. And when I was in the Vatican this last week talking to church officials, we were talking a lot about different areas of the just war theory. And I said, and I tried to say to as many as I could remember, that when the individuals who we say are responsible for the common good, whether they're theologians or politicians, when they give the charge to war and they judge the parameters of justice, they're not the ones who pull the triggers, and they're not the ones who come home with post-traumatic stress disorder. That's me. That's my friends here. We're the ones who do that. This is an incredibly personal account, or a personal endeavor. War is not fought by or for ideas. It's fought by individual persons who possess human will. I was able to meet an individual, the Pope, Pope Benedict XVI, and Benedict, when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, played a very significant role in the salvation of my faith. Growing up in an evangelical community, it was a bit of a rough transition when I started taking to philosophy, because the intellectual tradition in the evangelical world, in the words of Mark Knoll, who taught at Wheaton College, he said the scandal of the evangelical mind is that there really isn't an evangelical mind. And he wrote that while professor at Wheaton College. And I'll attest that it's not a unilateral, it's not a universal condemnation of the evangelical community by any means, but I certainly didn't meet with great reception the questions that I wanted to ask about all kinds of things. And it wasn't until I encountered ancient Christianity and the Catholic and Orthodox traditions, as well as the Anglican tradition, that I started finding some answers to my problems and to my questions. And when I read the book Introduction to Christianity, I thought maybe there's hope, because it's a beautiful, beautiful book written by then Cardinal Ratzinger. And when I spoke to the Pope, I said, my name is Joshua Castile. I was formerly a U.S. Army interrogator at Abu Ghraib prison, who then became a conscientious objector. And not only did your writings help to save my faith, but they also showed me a path of nonviolence, and ultimately led me to the Catholic Church. And I gave him a copy of the article that Griffin talked about, the Soldier's Magnificat, and I said, my hope is that my words might be able to bless you in the same way that your words blessed me. And he said, thank you, and he told me that he would pray for me. And there was a part of me that really wished I had not told him a single thing about Abu Ghraib, that I hadn't said a single word about the war, because this man, just as a person, really did play a huge role in my life and continues to, in the same way that John Paul II played in my life. And I wanted to be able to talk to him just as a pastor. and not as a person who is going to receive a political ideology from me or a theological campaign. Even though that was largely the reason why we were in Rome, was to talk about what was happening in the world. And so as I hear the stories this morning and this afternoon, I keep on trying to remember how to keep these theological and political agendas that we have in the context of human persons and human relationships, which is not something I'm incredibly adept in, because I tend to be a bit of a mind guy. I tend to be very convinced by ideologies and whatnot. But at the end of the day, those things don't sustain. And I take great counsel in the wisdom that was presented earlier about the daily discipline of prayer and finding strength in each other. I want to tell you one story more about Iraq, and then I'll hand it over to my colleagues, and then we'll be able to have a conversation. But in the process of becoming a conscientious objector, you have to have a moment of what's called the crystallization of conscience. And mine came when I interrogated a 22-year-old Saudi Arabian who told me that he came to Iraq specifically to fight jihad. And he was very open about that, and which I thought was puzzling, because our policy was that if you were a threat against coalition forces, you wouldn't go anywhere. So this guy was basically saying, I want to spend my life in jail. And he came into the room, and he was very meek-mannered, mild, and that was off-putting, because as an interrogator, you don't want a person to show you respect out of the free gift of their heart, because that gives them a position of power. You want to make sure that they have no choice but to respect you. And so I started asking him repeat questions and rapid-fire questions to get him off his game, to get him frustrated. And he hung with me for 20 minutes, and he never disrespected me. And I got tired of that technique, which was very common for me in Iraq. And we started talking about who recruited him, where he went, who he was going to fight with. And then I can't remember if I told him that I was a Christian or if he simply assumed so because I was an American. But he looked at me and he said, you're a very strange man. You don't follow the teachings of Jesus to love your enemies, to pray for those who persecute you, and to turn the other cheek. And I had already started writing my application for conscientious objection and had gone through about 100 interrogations. Had certainly become fed up about what was happening. And after he said that, I was completely silent for about a minute. And I said, you know what, I think you might be right. I don't really seem to make a whole lot of sense. It would make more sense if I was in your shoes, because the most important people in my life have all been prisoners. It's been Jesus, Paul, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And he said, I don't believe you. He said, if it was the will of God for me to spend the rest of my life in prison, I would accept the will of God. But I don't think you have the same kind of peace I have to accept that kind of fate. And for a second, I thought, well, maybe you're right about that too, because that's a pretty big thing to say, that I actually want to be staying in Abu Ghraib prison. But I realized that I was no longer doing what my job entailed of me. The textbook definition of interrogation is to exploit the greatest amount of intelligence in the least amount of time. And during the time that we were going through tactical or meetings where we talked about tactical exploitation, I was also reading John Paul II, who said that any time you reduce a person as a means to an end, as an object of exploitation, you participate in the culture of death. And which is mindful advice as far as the peace movement is concerned, to what degree we objectify persons in our own pursuits and fail to see the person with whom we debate or whom we want to convert, not necessarily spiritually, but politically, and see them as a means to an end. I went to my chain of command and I said, I can't interrogate him anymore. If you need to get information out of him, you're gonna have to find somebody else. Because if I go back in that room, all I'm going to see is a 22-year-old kid who's looking for answers, who's never fired a gun in his life. He's an idealistic kid who wants to defend Muslim lands from an aggressive army, which is basically the just war theory. And if I go back in that room, all I'm going to want to talk to him man to man, and I'm going to want to talk about ethics and religion and the cycle of vengeance, and say, Isn't it crazy that your people tell you it's okay to kill me and my people tell me it's okay to kill you? Why can't we take a different path together? But I certainly couldn't say that wearing the uniform, because it wasn't my job, and I didn't have the moral credibility to make that kind of an argument from where I stood. And a lot of that conflict goes back to the debate I had Thursday night with Lieutenant Colonel Kelly Jordan about my oath. I, Joshua Castile, swear to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and to bear true faith and allegiance to the same. Will follow the orders of the President of the United States and the officers appointed over me in accordance with the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The whole time that Baxter was speaking, I just wanted to like add exclamation points and highlight and underline somehow, like maybe through impromptu dance. when he was talking about our willingness to abdicate conscience to the nation state, and that's the main moment of the main reason why the secular peace movement became so incredibly exhausting to me is that I just couldn't possibly care any less about like who gets into office and whatnot. I'm sure some of that has to do with my proximity to the war and my age. But when I converted to Catholicism, right before I did, actually, I had a chance to go to Rome to see Pope John Paul II laid in state. And I waited in line for 20 hours. And when I made it into St. Peter's Square, we were surrounded by hundreds of thousands of people waving flags from Bolivia and Latvia and Poland. And it wasn't like the cathedral architecture that I'd seen in London just a couple days before, where all of the monuments are people holding guns and swords and magistrate this and colonel that. It was just Jesus at the top, surrounded by the apostles, and down below is Peter and Paul. And Peter is only holding the keys, and Paul is only holding the sword of the Spirit and the scroll, which is the Word of God. And I said, this is our eschatological destiny. We are the people that transcends local politics, that transcends the nation state, and we offer you truth and salvation, and that's it. And we will be sojourners in your struggles. But this is the community that I want to be a part of. But certainly a trip to Rome will show you that it's an eschatological journey and that there's a long road of catechesis and putting a hand to the plow and serving soup and providing jackets and blankets involved. And it's more about praying to change history rather than to make headlines. But before I hand over the mic, I thought I would break the cardinal rule of writers and read something that I just wrote. And it was in response to South Bend Tribune article. They wrongly said that I was dishonorably discharged, and I stormed into the office and said, no, I wasn't. But it was a perfect, this was a providential moment because it gave me the opportunity to ask to write a 600-word editorial in response. So I got to clarify some things about the debate that Colonel Jordan and I had. And this might give you a bit of a taste for what we talked about. In response to Ken Fowler's, who's the writer, 23 March article, Debate on War Gets Heated, concerning my discussion at Holy Cross College with the head of the Notre Dame Army Reserve Officer Training Corps, Lieutenant Colonel Kelly Jordan, I find it appropriate to offer a few short reflections. I am not primarily interested in the fact that the article wrongly indicated that I was dishonorably discharged after my 8 years of military service and tour of duty in Iraq as a U.S. Army interrogator and Arabic linguist at Abu Ghraib. The fate of those who attempt conscientious objection is in fact so fraught and perilous that the reasons why my discharge was honorable are few. The short of it, I did what I was told and discreetly sought my exodus. Had I vocalized my moral and political misgivings about U.S. defense policy while still a soldier, the same manner in which I did Thursday night, and undoubtedly this exodus from the Army would have been radically different. But of course that's the nature of the beast. Soldiers are sworn to protect democracy, not to practice it. Indeed, Lieutenant Colonel Jordan was not at liberty to discuss Thursday night his own views about the Iraq War in virtue of his oath as a commissioned officer. Lieutenant Colonel Jordan swore that he, quote, freely, without mental reservations or purpose of evasion, end quote, would dutifully execute his office. Lieutenant Colonel Jordan is an exceedingly honorable man whose moral bravery saved the lives of 34 Iraqis during the Gulf War. Many other soldiers, sailors, and Marines, Catholic or other, pursue to do likewise in their noble mission to serve their country. But in a time when we have witnessed two popes and the vast majority of the universal church decry the illegality, injustice, and immorality of the Iraq War, one must at least have a moment for pause to consider whether one's oath to a country is sufficient to closet ethical debate, moreover, ethical action. Section 2310 of the Catechism of the Catholic Church states, "Those who are sworn to serve their country in the armed forces are servants of the security and freedom of nations. If they carry out their duty honorably, they truly contribute to the common good of the nation and the maintenance of peace," end quote. Yet no honest witness of 20th century bloodshed can state that that a mere two sentences provide the state a blank check to determine the parameters of justice, let alone speak authoritatively for Catholic conscience, and the Catechism is not silent on this issue. Catholic conscience, formed by the entire teaching of the Church, with greater emphasis placed upon the gospel than catechetical teachings which may develop through history, leaves no easy out from the mandate to, quote, obey God rather than men, Acts 5:29. This is what led St. Martin of Tours, now the patron saint of soldiers, to state, "I am a soldier of Christ. It is not lawful for me to do violence." Would the Catechism have allowed St. Martin to serve his country? Absolutely. But the Catechism is a book of principles to aid the universal church and must always be localized to the practices of specific regions. In a country that prohibits the precise requirement of the just war tradition, i.e. selective objection to particular wars, how can a Catholic officer honestly state he or she has, quote, no mental reservations to fight in a war the Holy See has vociferously labeled illegal, unjust, and immoral? The greatest evil is done not at the hands of evil men, but through the silence and willing inaction of virtuous men. I haven't sent it in yet. If anybody has any comments or suggestions, you can see me afterwards before I send it into the paper. But being a peacemaker is a hard thing, and I don't necessarily consider myself to be one entirely, but Cardinal Stafford, who we met with, who is the prefect for the council that creates heinous or very creative penances for people who have done really heinous things, and he's also on the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, he said that you're walking a path, this whole issue of nationalism, of fidelity to the kingdom of God above and beyond the kingdoms of men, it's going to be a lonely journey. And there are people that might be sympathetic to ideas, but walking it out in practicality is not a well-traveled path. And I remember watching The Lord of the Rings, which I think is the perfect metaphor for the Christian path and the role of power, that we're supposed to be ring bearers and not ring wearers. Whereas the church is usually Boromir and others who try to put on the ring of power and use it against their enemies. Where Frodo's in the garden in the Elven garden, and Galadriel, he says to Galadriel, "I know what I have to do, but I'm scared to do it. I feel so very much alone." And Galadriel said to Frodo, "Frodo Baggins, to be a bearer of the ring of power is to be alone." And on the one hand, there's a certain comfort in hearing words like that, in the same way that Mother Teresa said there weren't really any days in her life where she felt warm fuzzies, or when Dorothy Day talks about the long loneliness of serving the poor and being an instrument of truth, because the world doesn't pat you on the back when it happens. But it's certainly a call to communion, not just ecclesially, but fraternally, and finding ways to, and I'm preaching to myself when I say this, because it was a very heated debate the other night, finding ways of forming alliances with those who used to be me and still are. And I don't say that in a sense of a rival, but... well, in whatever sense I'm capable of saying. So in that, I'm going to pass it off to my colleagues, and then we'll have a discussion.